All right, so here we are at Lang.next. We're with a couple of the Julia people, Stefan Karpinski, Jeff Bezenson.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned about Julia basically very briefly by reading these, from reading a blog. And I was very curious when I was reading things like As Fast as C, It's Much Simpler, blah, blah, blah. So we invited you here to talk about it. So for everybody out in the audience, tell us, what is Julia?
So to me, Julia is kind of part of a trend that we've seen some examples of at this conference of dynamic languages kind of having a better story about types.
And performance.
And performance. So we think there's, you know, dynamic languages are changing, and dynamic and static are kind of converging, and static is becoming more dynamic, and the dynamic is performing better and getting some features. So, and you know, we're part of that. And so, yeah, I mean, our goal is to have C-like performance. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not quite there yet, but in some cases we're very close, but only in some cases.
Okay, and so do you guys run in a virtual machine? Do you compile the native code? What's the story?
We use LLVM, and it's everything is just-in-time compiled. Code is very, very aggressively specialized. So what ends up happening with just-in-time aggressive specialization is that you don't actually need to annotate types because you know what the types of things are because you have the actual values at the time.
Mm.
The type annotations we thought initially might be more helpful for performance than they are. They're actually not that useful. What they are useful for is they allow us to do multiple dispatch, which is really useful for numerical and technical computing, which is our area of focus.
Perfect. Well, that's a great segue because that was what I was going to ask. I mean, is this a general purpose programming language or is it mainly domain specific in the context of the problem space that you would use it to solve?
Yeah, that is a good question. And I guess what we would say is it's we do want it to be a good general purpose language, but it has to be good for working on the, you know, the kinds of problems you see in technical and mathematical computing.
Okay.
It has to be natural and concise for linear algebra. I mean, as good as MATLAB, which is the sort of that's the de facto standard for writing linear algebra algorithms. We'd like it to be as convenient as R for statistics. And we also want it to be good at other things like string processing. You should be able to do networking. You should be able to do, you know, if you want to write a web server in Julia, it shouldn't be a problem.
Interesting.
Yeah, but yeah. So, you know, like we really would think it's more of a matter of priorities rather than picking one or the other. It's just it's just a matter of how you order the priorities.
So can we talk a little bit about, you know, it's always interesting when new languages are invented.
Mm-hmm.
So now that this is so recently invented, it's fun to talk about this. So, you know, what led to the need to create a specific language like Julia versus using various languages to solve a problem? That's a strange question.
I personally, no. It's you know, why some people just make a language to scratch an itch.
Mm-hmm.
Something, you know, they wanted to change the keyword in some mm-hmm. other language. I found myself writing code in, you know, 6 or 7 different languages. I found myself writing, you know, Ruby scripts that would tie together pieces of MATLAB code, that would tie together pieces of R code for plotting, that would, you know, also tied to, you know, generating SQL.
Mm.
And it just got frustrating. And I wanted to write in one language and not have to drop down to C in order to get something fast,
mm.
but also be able to do, you know, have all my nice high level stuff at the same time.
I understand.
I don't know anything that can, I mean, if I knew something, I would be using it. I don't know anything that can do, you know, primarily the number crunching as conveniently and as quickly as I would like it.
But I mean, isn't that, I mean, you guys are from MIT, and the de facto language at MIT, correct me if I'm wrong, appears to be Python.
It is now. It was Scheme for a long
okay.
time.
Okay. Yeah. And so Python and Python C, specifically, I mean, you have sort of this native thing you can use, and it's a very mathematically capable. We use it in MSR a lot
mm-hmm.
for the scientists to crunch numbers and test things out. What is it about Python that just didn't work out for you?
Well, so I mean, Python is a good language. It's it is well designed, but I don't think it was intended to be able to really solve absolutely everything. I'm pretty confident that when it was designed, he wasn't imagining that this is going to be a scientific computing language. That's probably the one thing he wasn't expecting to use it for. Mm. But really, there was the practical motivations for Julia, of course, like Stefan said, but also from kind of a more pure language perspective. Mm. There's been, people love dynamic languages and the convenience of them, but there's kind of aversion to talking about types. Mm-hmm. And yet, the ideas of optional typing and gradual typing and that sort of thing have been around. But and the benefit of it seems pretty clear. It's like you get some benefits of types when you want, and otherwise mm-hmm. you don't have to worry about it. Mm-hmm. And yet, there haven't been a lot of practically successful languages that actually provide that. Okay. So this is, just from a pure language perspective, this is kind of our attempt to, provide a system like that that's practically useful.
So Julia is optionally typed?
Yes.
Dart kind of sense? In a Gilad sense?
It's somewhat similar to that, actually.
It's not
yes.
as permissive as Dart. Okay. And it also only has mm-hmm. expression context. You can't, which means that if you name a type that doesn't and it doesn't exist, it doesn't just ignore it and say that's fine. It will say that value doesn't mean anything to me.
Okay.
So it is somewhat similar to that idea in the sense that there is a sort of language of types that you can use as a conceptual framework. You can use it for making declarations and describing values. If, as, and when you want to. So in that sense, it's in the same spirit.
I wanted to briefly return to the NumPy and Python thing. Mm-hmm. For me, one of the disconnects in Python that comes from the fact that it wasn't designed, it was designed to have an easy, understandable object system. And because of that, it has arrays that hold references to objects. And that means that you can't get good memory layout for things like linear algebra, which means that NumPy has a completely different system for arrays and vectors. And you have to translate back and forth between them, and that just creates this continual friction, and it's very easy to forget which one you're working with. Mm-hmm. And so for us in Julia, you don't have to worry about that. The arrays are always good for doing linear algebra.
Excellent. Yeah. No, and I mean I think it's like unfortunate sometimes when people think like, oh, why does you have to create a new language? It's great mm-hmm. that you create a new language to solve these specific sets of problems. Now, let's move on more to the language itself. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about like the superficial aspect of the language, which is the stuff developers actually type mm-hmm. and then try to reason about. So we
didn't want to innovate in syntax, really. I think the syntax is very bland and simple and as spare as possible.
Looks a lot like MATLAB.
Yeah, you want a lot of things
without all of the weird syntax quirks that MATLAB has, but a lot of stuff just ports.
Okay. Yeah,
straight
but it's,
over.
It's in the Python syntax school of looking like pseudocode.
Okay.
That's a lot of the idea.
It's kind of an interesting anecdote. We used the .j extension on GitHub for a while, which GitHub interprets as Objective-J, and people thought we had real syntax highlighting because the syntax is so uninnovative. Mm. You could just pick a random language.
It looked pretty decent. People thought, oh, you've got syntax highlighting support.
Because I mean, strings look like strings, and function calls look like function calls. It's F parentheses arguments. That's it.
So yeah, the innovation is not in the syntax really.
So I mean, then you have curly braces or
no.
semicolons.
No.
No?
Wow. Semicolons. Optional statement separator, but always optional.
Yeah. I think it was Guy Steele who once said that the problem with programming language design is that there aren't enough brackets in ASCII. And so we felt that it was just, it would be criminal to waste curly braces on blocks. Mm. So they're not used for blocks. They're actually used for type parameters. So the type system is fairly sophisticated. It has parametric types, generic types. It even has dependent types, which means you can have integer values as type parameters.
We also use the curly braces for heterogeneous arrays.
Yeah, a couple other things, but not for blocks in any case.
Heterogeneous arrays meaning they could be an array of ints and strings.
Yeah, you can
yeah
put
anything.
An array you can put anything in.
Wow,
yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So it seems like this is useful for sort of high performance cloud computing. Is that fair? Is that one approach? Like, are you guys thinking about using this for big data?
Yeah,
machine
absolutely.
Learning?
Absolutely. I mean, we already have, it's interesting, we don't yet have a threading model. What we do have, though, is we have a parallel computing model on a distributed system. So you can have, it has a global address space that is shared across, you know, however many machines you have working on a problem. And you can just reference, you can send a computation to another machine, or you can just reference a result on another machine, and it's all transparently sent back and forth.
We have a distributed computing package that's written as a library, and we have we've done things like we've done experiments of interfacing to some cloud APIs and doing things like starting VM instances on demand and adding processors, and you can communicate with them and run things on them.
Interesting.
And we have a sort of preliminary distributed array type implemented on top of that.
And so, what about safety and that type of thing, right? So.
Depends on what kind of safety you mean.
So, type safety.
So, the type system is really more a matter of annotations that are assertions. So, if you assert that something is of a type and it's not that type, you'll get a runtime error.
Okay.
The type safety is entirely runtime.
But the types are not checked. They could be checked as a heuristic to say, we know this couldn't possibly work.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, we don't do that at this point. Instead, what we do is check it at runtime and also use it for dispatch. But there's no type checking, which actually it frees you up with a lot of things. For example, having a dependent type system, it's an undecidable problem if you need to type check it. But we don't care because we're not type checking it.
So let's talk to the people in the audience might not know what a dependent type is. So can you talk about that for a second?
A dependent type is a type that depends on a program term or just a runtime value, essentially. You can construct a type out of an object you made at runtime.
Yeah, so just to give a concrete example of a little bit of syntax, the array type is written like this, and this is the element type, and this is that's the dimension of the array. So you could write something like V is of this type, where T is an actual type. You could, for example, write N64 or float 64. The dimension could be 1 for a vector or 2. So on, tensors of any size, and then you would just take V and index into it. The dependent part about the type system is that you're allowed to have a value like 1, 2, 3 as a type parameter. In other type systems, you would just be able to have types as type parameters. You would only be able to have the list type.
I see.
So, and what it lets you do is something like when you construct an array. You could have a tuple of dimensions, which is built up dynamically, so you wouldn't be able to statically know what the length of it is. So it could be any size, and the type of array you'll get is has an n value there, which is the length of the dimensions tuple.
Right.
So the rank of the array would be determined at runtime, but it's still part of the type.
Right.
Okay.
And because that rank could be computed by something that type checker can't actually predict. That's why it's not something you can do in a statically typed language.
Great.
But the way our compiler works, we do discover type information. So it's possible that we could provide an optional compiler switch or something like that, where it would be able to print type warnings to you about potential problems it's found if you want. We haven't done that yet, but it's possible.
Yeah.
Sure.
But it wouldn't be a full type safety.
Yeah. It's sort of I feel like the statically typed languages are getting more and more dynamic. They're adding REPLs, they're sort of letting you, using type inference to let you feel like you're not actually statically typing things, although the compiler is actually figuring out what the static types are for you.
Mm-hmm.
We're approaching it from the other end, which is taking a dynamic dynamic system with only dynamic runtime semantics, which is keeps things from being confusing. It makes it much easier for people to understand conceptually what's going on, because they don't have to think, what's the compile time type, what's the runtime type. Mm. There is no compile time type. It doesn't mean anything. Mm. But you can get a lot of the benefits of, I mean, we're already getting the performance benefits of a statically typed language, and in the future, one thing we could do is add some of the safety benefits by checking as much as you can.
Mm.
But it's one of those things where at some point you're still allowed to give up. You know, mm. you can just say, well, this is a little too complicated. We're going to trust that what you've done here is okay, and if there is an error, then we'll let you know at runtime, but we can maybe check some things at compile time.
Mm. So let's talk a little bit about the performance characteristics. I mean, what makes Julia fast? I mean, that's a very broad question, but I'm just curious.
Mostly Jeff. So, Jeff mostly makes Julia fast.
All right. Jeff? Right on.
The key source of performance is type information. And we've sort of designed everything from the beginning to, you know, even though we're dynamically typed, to be able to provide, you know, as much type information, as much good type information as we sort of can possibly reasonably get. Mm-hmm. And when we do that with a type inference algorithm, that's a data flow based type inference. So we typically do have a fair amount of type information, and then we can use that to specialize code. And in particular, it's used, or since the unifying model of Julia, if you will, is multiple dispatch.
Mm.
Every operation is picked by looking at the types of all of the arguments and picking the most specific method. And so all of execution time, really, in theory, is just, you know, figuring out which method to call. And so the performance comes from the fact that when we know the types, we can, you know, we can statically resolve the method calls and inline them and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, even when you write something that's very generic, like, I don't know, let's say you decided you didn't want to bother with types, and you just want to say something like, get four, and you give it a vector, and it just there's a long function syntax, but ends with end, and you can do something. Okay. But it's so common to write very very short functions,
mm-hmm.
that we added a very short, you know, one expression syntax. So
okay.
you can just you know, index into this thing and get the fourth element or something like that. And now, you know, this, if you had to generate completely generic code that could operate on any type of V, then, you know, it would be very slow, because it has to check the type of V, it has to figure out how to index into it. But what ends up happening is that the first time this is called on a specific type, let's say it's called on an array, you know, V is an array of type int 64, and it's one-dimensional, this actually gets compiled to a specific method for just that type. And so what ends up happening is that is very fast. And if you call this somewhere, it's probably going to get inlined.
Okay.
So not only is it specific to the type, but it's also inlined into the calling code. And so you end up with good performance. You end up with this being basically the same performance that you would get in C.
Now, what if it happened to be a heterogeneous array that you guys support as a type? That's going to have penalties.
Well, yes. if we knew that it was a heterogeneous array, then we would at least know the representation. So it would be basically a pointer load.
Got it.
But we wouldn't know the type of the thing you get out of it.
Mm.
Right.
But you would after you computed it.
Yeah. Well, then what generally happens is once you have the thing whose type we don't know statically, you'll pretty soon do some operation on it, and then at that point we'll sort of intercept its type through method dispatch, and then we can continue in a well-typed function that's fast.
So let's talk a little bit about, I mean, as they're breaking things down here, I mean, this is the end of the event, which has been really nice. So kind of, you know, silly questions, but sometimes I think underrated in some sense. Why did you call it Julia? It is the Julia set, the mathematical Julia set in fractal world, or what is this?
Yeah, this is you know, the most common question. This is what everyone wants to know, really.
It's interesting.
Yes, it's very interesting. I think, was it Don Knuth who said that the most important thing about programming language is the name?
Is the name.
I think that was very wise.
Yeah. Some true facts that are irrelevant to the name. My first girlfriend was named Julia.
Ah.
But it's irrelevant. That's not why I picked the name.
Okay.
my cousin's daughter is named Julia. This is true facts, but unrelated.
Okay.
Well, I don't know. We didn't really have a reason.
So one of my friends actually claims that he came up with the name, and that I was just talking to him one time, and he said, you know, you should call it Julia. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, that doesn't mean anything. Why would you call it that? And mm-hmm. then a week later, I decided, yeah, that's a good name.
Totally. Well, like I say, I mean, there's the Julia set.
There yes, is. Yeah.
And that's actually quite beautiful.
People often think of that, so that's a good association. That's fine. Yeah.
Run with it, but it's good. So the best thing is there is no answer.
Yeah, there is no real answer.
That's great.
It just undefined. We just think it sounds nice, and every
first time
everyone hears it, they just say, "Yeah, Julia."
Yeah,
it's a good name.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
So you know, in some sense, what did you think of what you kind of learned and engaged the other speakers? I mean, Bloom was really cool.
Oh, I mean this has been. It's been great. I mean,
cool.
Having dinner the first night we were here with you know, various like programming language luminaries is kind of amazing. Sitting there like, you know, arguing about IEEE semantics with Walter Bright and having him regale us with how insane it is to implement a C preprocessor. And, you know.
Yeah, really great group of people at this conference. You know, tremendous event.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really thrilling to be around. You know, this group of people.
Cool. Yeah. Now let's talk a little bit about where Julia's going. I realize it's just, you know, just. You just made the announcement not that long ago.
Yeah.
But like, what are you guys working on right now? What sort of problems are you solving at the language level?
We've got a few big changes on our plate. We're shooting in our initial announcement. We said it was time for version one, and we haven't quite gotten there yet because we want version one is a promise of stability. It's like Go version one.
Got it.
You know, once you do that, you don't make breaking changes until version two.
Mm-hmm.
We want to make record types immutable, or defaults to immutable and have optionally mutable fields, because that just enables a lot of really good things. And mostly you don't actually want to mutate things when you've created a new object. One of the other things is keyword arguments. We really need to have keyword arguments. It's just, you know, the work just needs to get done.
Sure.
And we're also working on some kind of a module system.
Yeah.
Which is the work on that's well underway, actually, so it should be done fairly soon.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of successful languages have lived forever without a module system. C doesn't have one.
C++ doesn't have modules, right? Well,
it has namespaces.
And what we have may just amount to namespaces, you know,
okay.
in many people's view, which is okay.
Sure, well, absolutely. You
know, we'll have to see.
So let me ask this then. I mean, since you're operating in some of the best, one could argue, there's some great mathematics libraries out there written in C.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, how do you interoperate with the C?
We have very good C interoperability.
Great.
Since we're doing everything as native code generation with LLVM, you know, you can just emit a call to a C function very easily. And we expose a really convenient syntax for that too. It's very easy to open a library. You don't even necessarily need to recompile anything. You can just open a shared library and call a function in it.
Nice.
Yeah, you just, because we have an explicit way of talking about types in the language, we can just actually express what the signature of a C function is at the call site, and then emit the code that is basically one. It's a function call instruction.
Sure.
That's it.
Great.
So.
Yeah, and this is a classic case where, you know, languages that otherwise would resist talking about types would sort of be forced to talk about types, because if you have to write a C signature, you have to have some way of telling the language what the signature is.
Mm.
So you would have to have maybe a string or a symbol name or something to give the C type. And, you know, to us at that point, why not just be able to you know, say what the type actually is?
Great.
In terms of the language's, you know, usual types. So that's what we do.
Now, what about sort of shared state? I mean, that's not computational performance critical thing. Sometimes shared state is good. I mean, that's at least what the Go guys told me today in our interview, and people have already watched.
So currently, we don't do any shared memory concurrency.
Okay.
So it's strictly a message based type of thing.
Actor based.
So, we have coroutines as a control flow mechanism essentially, but they all run within a single kernel thread.
Okay.
But yeah, it's just multi-processing. You start multiple instances, and we have a pretty high-level, easy-to-use interfaces for communicating and putting values between machines and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Now, where can people who are watching this right now go and download this and play with it?
Well, we have it's julialang.org is the URL.
Cool.
It's pretty straightforward.
And it'll be in the description of the video, but it's good to write it down anyway.
Yeah, and it's all the code is on GitHub. It actually has been in forever. We used GitHub from development from a very early stage.
Okay.
People are welcome to try it and, you know.
Is it open so can people sort of help evolve it?
Oh, absolutely.
Very, very, very open. We're up to about 40 contributors now, in fact.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. Cool. Well, hey, great to meet you. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, thank
and
you.
And your talk was recorded, so, of course, people will watch that as well to get much more deeper information. Mm-hmm. But
great.
We wanted to have a Channel 9 conversation with you guys, which is
great.
Not presentational.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Right on. Nice to meet you. Great work.
Likewise. Thanks for the interview.
Sure.
Yeah.